again, I get funnier.
Look, I don't know what the hell your point is, but I don't...
The point is of no return, and you've reached it.
Paperback Crisis.
Oh, yeah, we're past the point of no return, a.k.a. the halfway point of the show. These are the Desperate Hours on 91.5 FM WMFO in Medford. 7:04 Eastern Time, by the way. Anyway, backing me up once again, Herb Alpert. This time the Peppermint Clock Gum Shuffle from the 1966 ad campaign, courtesy of the Candy Wrapper Museum. By the way, they have a channel on YouTube, so check that out, the Candy Wrapper Museum on YouTube. And they put up videos. They have regarding the book that was just uploaded, so you get to look at what you're going to buy at the conclusion of this broadcast, correct? Anyway, let me tell you what I played in this last set of the first hour. Just heard Paperback Writer by the Beatles, which I was informed by Joe Lacey On this day in 1966, it received U.S. gold certification. It was released in May, so in 2 months it went gold. And they probably had a couple of other singles. They're probably approaching it if they hadn't passed it. Beatles, Paperback Writer, single on Capitol, 1966. For that, the Marlon Rashid with something completely different, Twisting in the Tub, a track originally released in Mud in 1959. Not to stray too far from the Candy theme. Came off the compilation Bugle Volume 2, which was on Candy Records in 1991. For that, the Bonesy Creek, and Candy Coated Lady. Previously unreleased acetate recorded in 1967 after compilation, the two CD set, Psychedelic States Colorado, came out in 2007 on Gear Fab. And we kicked off the set, the last set of the first hour, with Mouse in the Traps with Made of Sugar, Made of Spice, track originally released on Fraternity in 1966. I ain't gonna lie, I got off the Nuggets box set, CD3, came out in 1998 on Rhino. Anyway, about a minute late for this. Here's my interview with Darlene Lacey, curator of the Candy Wrapper Museum. And she talks about the Candy Wrapper Museum, its genesis, and how it led to her two new books, Necco, An Epic Candy Tale, and Necco, The Archive Collection, An Almost Lost History of the New England Confectionery Company. I hope you enjoy it. Really fast 28 minutes, if you ask me. These are the Desperate Hours on WMFO in Medford.
I want to welcome you to the Desperate Hours. You know, and I don't know why. We've known each other probably like 10 or 11 years on that internet-y kind of way. And I never thought to have you on. I don't know why. See, I took you for granted. I'm really sorry about that. But you have a book. What's that?
No, go ahead. I was saying, I've just been waiting in the wings.
There you go. Well, you have two books coming out. Not one, but two. Necco, An Epic Candy Tale. And then a second book, Necco, The Archive Collection, An Almost Lost History of the New England Confectionery Company. We could start it off, actually, just with a little fun thing. I have a question for you. You have a question for me. You have a question for me, which is candy related. And I have one for you, which is Desperate Hours related. I don't know how, you know, it could be something only I know anyway, but yeah, we'll have you taking a wild guess. Anyway, speaking of the Desperate Hours, been on the air for, you know, in its current incarnation for 9 years. And my question is, the Desperate Hours started as a podcast in 2006, B, started as my radio show in college in 1982, and three, was broadcast on terrestrial radio in Berlin, Germany for a year. Which one is the lie?
Which one is the lie? I'm going to guess the podcast.
You're right. Right. I probably mentioned it before. You listen, I don't. So that's what happened.
Well, I'm a loyal listener. How long have I been listening to this show now? Gosh, it's been 7 years. I'm not sure how long. I've lost track of time.
I came back on the air in 2013, May of 2013. So about probably almost that long, actually. Might have been that long. I know Laurel Schizen was one of my first listeners, and she did the running commentaries that you eventually would take over.
Laurel was great, wasn't she?
Yes, oh, absolutely. We knew each other from Words with Friends, and I was surprised when Laura Taylor brought her onto the BLR page, a BLR group. And, you know, I knew it. Like, I used to eat squeak by a one or two out of 10. And she'd slaughter me the rest of the time. And, you know, she had a good, she had a way with words.
That's interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny how things, work out. How you get to know people. Like you say, I think it's been 10 or 11 years. You and I have been, but we weren't this active, but, it was, yeah. Been a long time. Time flies.
It's the best of social media, right? For all the friends you lose, is the ones you keep.
Yeah, and exactly. Well, yeah, it's social. You know, I think our friendship, you know, and including Joe in that, is, you know, it's with social media. That's how it ideally should work. So that's, you know, that's you know, I'm, it makes me very happy. It gives me hope. A little hope for humanity anyway.
Well, yeah. I've dragged you into the whole world of candy and candy history.
Yeah.
And I have my two truths and a tall tale for you. And these are based on Necco candy history, since this is the thing that I am immersed in these days. And since you are from the area, perhaps you can suss out which one of these is a lie. So with Necco, you know, one of the things that I have found constantly, I talk about, hey, I'm doing Necco history, I'm writing these books, and people are always like, oh, Necco wafers, right? Or they might know the Necco Sky Bar or Sweethearts, you know, certain candies like that, but they don't realize that Necco actually was making hundreds of different types of confections at a time. From the year that they started in 1901, they used to boast about their over 500 sweets that they were making. So as I was working on my books, I started my own compilation of Necco candy names so that I could just count up as many as I could. And I got up to 1,380. And along the way, there were some pretty cool candy names. And so I'm going to give you three of them. You tell me which one is not for real. They are Mr. Sweet Tooth, TV Dinner, or Toasted Twins.
Repeat the first one.
Mr. Sweet Tooth.
I think A is false.
You are incorrect. In fact, a Mr. Sweet Tooth candy bar. In fact, another one called Mr. Chairman. There seemed to be a little bit of a Mr. theme with their candy bars back in the 20s and the early days. But the one that did not exist was TV Dinner.
Why do I think TV Dinner was a candy bar, some sort of confection?
Well, I'll tell you this, because for one reason, there were many candy bars that were named things along those lines. And Necco made one called Big Lunch, one called Free Lunch, one called Luncheon, one called Quick Lunch, and another one called Television Lozenges. So it's not far from the truth, but somehow they missed it, or maybe they made it and I just didn't find it for my list. You never know with Necco.
So that's, you know, I have my own little Boston box, and if it was produced by somebody in Pennsylvania, I'm not going to know it. In a lot of your interviews, and I listened to just about all of them, if I haven't listened to all of them, you started your collection in the mid-70s. At what point, you know, the internet became widely available to everybody around 1995 and 1996. During that time, you were collecting the candy wrappers. At what point did you think about a candy wrapper museum? You know, did you wait 20 years? Or?
I had the idea for the Candy Wrapper Museum before I even collected my first candy wrapper.
Oh, God. All right.
That was my vision. You know, for being kind of a dumb kid, every once in a while I had these great ideas. And the Candy Wrapper Museum was one of them, where I was just basically, I don't know, 15 or 16 years old. And I had these older friends and they had collections. They collected, you know, imported beer bottles and other things like that. They had these really neat labels. And I thought, wow, I'd love to have a collection of something like that. But I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money, really. The only thing I had was spending money for candy. And so I thought, well, wow, what if I started a candy wrapper collection? But I wanted it to be something more than just a collection because it seems so mundane. It's a candy wrapper collection. So I thought, what if it were the Candy Wrapper Museum? And this would be something that I would basically collect through my life until I was an old woman. God knows what age that was, supposed to be 30. I don't know. And I would start, I'd open up a roadside attraction, the Candy Wrapper Museum, and I would display everything there. And the idea was that it wasn't just like I've collected every candy wrapper known to man, but it was more like these are the candy wrappers I think are really special or interesting in some way. So I collected them if I thought they were humorous or ephemeral, they weren't going to be around long, or they had some sort of artistic quality. And this was the criteria that I mostly used for collecting for the Candy Wrapper Museum.
Wow. So you actually had designs, you thought of the Candy Wrapper Museum, like a brick and mortar? I mean,
yes, I did. I wanted to set it up in the desert. There was a place out in the desert that inspired me. It was just like in the middle of Death Valley somewhere. It was by a cafe. It wasn't even a museum, but outside of this cafe gas station, they had these rocks in the ground with this little sign. I still have a photo of it. Rocks from famous places. And they put little signs next to each rock to say where the rocks came from. And I thought, who is to prove or disprove this? It takes a certain mind to create a collection, rocks from famous places. And I just thought, if you can do that, you can make a brick and mortar candy wrapper museum.
Well, absolutely. Well, there's museums that are in, sometimes you take hole-in-the-wall diners. Like locally, there's a Museum of Bad Art, which is all paintings that are found in the trash or at flea markets and whatnot. It's held at a restaurant in Norwood, Massachusetts, just south of Boston. It used to be closer to my house, but they moved it. And yeah, you know, I would have never thought about that. That's why I'm so impressed by you. You know, 40-something years ago, 48 years ago, 45 years ago, you would have thought of a candy wrapper museum. That would have right over my head.
The thing that was funny about it too is that people just caught on. Like my friends, family, people would say, hey, I've got something for the Candy Wrapper Museum. It's a very easy idea once people were aware of it to go, oh, I get it. You want some wacky thing, or I brought this back from Belgium for you, or what have you. So a lot of my wrappers, especially early on, were donations from inspired friends and family.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's excellent. I'm glad you have that kind of support. Now, when you went online, you must have hopped right on it, taking the Candy Wrapper Museum to the web.
That's right. You know, as you know, Alex, but probably other people don't, I'm a bit of a techie. I was an early game designer, computer games and producer. And so I had my own computer early on and knew how to work some HTML and whatnot. And so I think it was 2003 or maybe early 2004, I'm not sure. I just got the idea, maybe I should make a website for the Candy Wrapper Museum, because up to that point, the Candy Wrapper Museum was in, you know, bank boxes and grocery store bags and all this stuff just stacked and piled around my house. And so I dug everything out and I looked at it to see if the wrappers had basically matured like fine wine enough that they would be of interest to anybody. And they had. And that was when I realized that really almost anything, no matter how mundane it seems, if you put it away for 20 years, the world has changed significantly enough that you say, wow, I remember that. Or the world has changed or something about it. Or I thought this was going to be around forever and it isn't. And so I went ahead and took photos and scanned my wrappers, just the best of everything, because I had way too many to put on the website. And right. So I set up this website, and I was surprised it got this immediate big reaction. I've had millions of people come visit the website, and it was written up. It was the Yahoo, funny website of the week and all this kind of stuff. And I found some articles where people were saying, well, now the world is just really spun off its axis because now we have a candy wrapper museum. What's next? So I'm thrilled with the reaction.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing, is to do something different. It's what I've always thought, you know, always thought myself, is, you know, if you present something different but relatable, you know, it's going to be a hit of some kind. I think, you know, and you definitely hit the mark there. Now, you started all this with the Candy Wrapper Museum. You had your collection now going well over 40 years in the website. You got some attention from the press. How did the CFO think of you? I probably answered the question, but how did the CFO of NECO think of you to send all the ephemera to and the history?
Well, it wasn't the CFO, but the vice president of research and development.
Oh, okay.
But he was, you know, obviously high up and very plugged in. I mean, he was basically, you know, people bandy around this Willy Wonka concept a lot, but he really was the Willy Wonka of NECO, where he's there in his lab working out new recipes and testing the candy and all of that. That's really kind of like the nerve center of candy development. And so he was always very interested in the history of NECO. You know, they were working for many years. I think he started in the late 80s. It's in my book. was there for many, many decades, you know, before NECO closed their doors in 2018. And so he was working out of the Cambridge facility, which had been built in 1927. And they moved to Revere in 2003. And so he was in that old building that was really like a time capsule to begin with. They had hardly thrown out anything in all the decades that the company had been there. And so he was able to access all these old, you know, recipes, and, you know, everyone's still running the old machinery and they've got the old furniture and all this old stuff. And so when the company moved to Revere, they had, you know, pragmatically, they had to throw out a lot of stuff, which was unfortunate. And he knew a lot of candy history would be lost forever. So he bought some pieces at auction. He saved some things. And at the end, he was looking through the dumpsters and seeing what was just being thrown out. And so he salvaged a number of things and he had them all in his basement. And he had decided it was time to kind of thin things out a little bit. And so he found the Candy Wrapper Museum online and wrote to me and asked me, would you like this old scrapbook that I saved from the dumpster during the move? And this was after NECO had gone out of business. And so I said, sure. I was excited, you know, but I thought I was picturing something more like, you know, like a junior high school scrapbook kind of thing. And the scrapbook shows up, it's like straight out of, I don't know, Harry Potter, Grandpa Munster, you name it, like this humongous scrapbook that smelled like soot. And it was from the 1950s. And you open it up, this grimy, you know, scrapbook, and you find these incredible huge pages that were just meticulously preserved candy wrappers and boxes from the 1950s and before. And I had never seen anything like what was within the, you know, the covers of the scrapbook. And as a candy collector, I would know this stuff, I would recognize it. And I realized this was a lot of candy history that had not seen the light of day since it was on store shelves. And so my husband Joe and I, we decided it would be a shame to just put it away in my closet or what have you. We should share this with the world because it was saved for all these decades. And so this is what led to the making of the book, which turned into two books because there was so much in it and so much NECO history that it was too much to contain in one book.
Yeah, I can't wait to get my copies. Now, there was one question you would let's see. Yeah. Of course. Helps to be prepared. Anyway. I did play a part in this. Like I like to say, I had said publicly that I have a dog in this fight. I'm not going to be disingenuous and say, you know, well, how'd you think of me to take the photos? today photos of the building. But what was your thinking when you went into, you know, whether you hired me or the man on the moon to take the photos? What was your thinking when you went to take the current state of the buildings, photos of the current state of the buildings?
Well, it's sort of, I'll try to make a short answer out of a long process, but as I was researching NECO's history, I really wanted to find as much firsthand information as I could, because, you know, you can find these company histories and blog articles and all of that, and they're mostly accurate. There are a few inaccuracies, but, you know, it's a game of telephone. As time goes on, history starts to just sort of morph a little bit. And so I really wanted to get as much history as I could from the newspaper articles the day that things were happening. I was on newspapers.com every day, looking through every year by year for NECO history, looking through old advertisements and magazines, finding any kind of promotions and commercials. What was happening at the time? I wanted to know. And so in the search for authenticity, you know, you look at things and you say, well, there's the news story that broke, or here's a photo of some, you know, the factory long ago or what have you. But there's really no replacement in many ways for just being able to be there and be at the site where these things happened as well and get the vibe of it. And so one of the wonderful things about writing a book like this in today's age is Google Maps. And so I went on Google Maps and I walked the streets of Cambridge and South Boston, Summer and Melcher and Lansdowne and Massachusetts Avenue and all of that. And I took screenshots so that I could look and examine all the different angles and see what was going on. And as I was doing that, I was just wishing that I could walk the streets here. And I know I could hop on a plane and I could do that, but I'm in Los Angeles. And also this is a time of COVID. I was working on this project. And so I was thinking, wouldn't it be great to just be there with a friend and just go on a tour and walk around? And of course I thought of my friend, Alex, and you, that you had an eye for photography because I had seen your wonderful photos of many times. And so anyway, I just thought, should I ask Alex? I know this is a big favor, but I'm so glad I did because you took fantastic pictures. And I think that the part of the book, the chapter at the back, which has your photos where it shows NECO then and now, the buildings that still stand and the memories people have of NECO, I think it's one of the most powerful parts of the book. It's my favorite part of the book.
Thank you. There has been a lot of changes in the area, and somehow like the building in Melcher, I think I sent you an archival photo of early 70s. And it changed from manufacturing to warehousing and then to offices over the years. Now, that whole complex is now General Electric. They moved their headquarters about 7 or 8 years ago to Boston. And their R&D is all in that area. And so it was literally for Skybars, but NECO wafers were made there so many years ago, nearly a century ago. And now GE occupies the space. For a while, the place, and I finally remember the name of the place. It was Bainbridge, New England. It was at the corner of Melcher Street at the bend, and they sold wholesale office supplies and small equipment. And I worked for an office supply house, and I used to go in there and pick up stuff and bring it back to the store with a truck or sometimes on foot. Now, this was, 45 years ago. The memories of South Boston, I remember, and I have a book about it. My father owned a grocery store years ago, and it's nowhere near NECO, but it is definitely the seafront, which is would be behind me if the Melcher Street building is behind you, where Atlantic Avenue used to have trains and a locomotive that would pick up, freight cars or refrigerated cars from South Station, drop them off, pick up others, and then drop them off at North Station. And it was in the middle of the street So like you would be, and this was up until about 1970. And I remember that I was a little kid when my dad had the store, but you would see this locomotive coming at you, like they probably doing about 20 miles an hour or whatever. But my father would typically be driving about 50. And that's one of my memories. One of my memories of the area, within a couple of blocks in Cambridge, and this was well into my adulthood, into the 80s, early 90s, you had Necco three blocks one way, Squirrel Nut three blocks another way. There was Superior Nut, who was all, and it was from your text, is owned by the people who own Deer Inn, the Schrafs building. Flatley did a good job of just maintaining that facade, and they liked it. They kept the sign. It's wonderful to see at night. It's how bright it is and everything. There's a certain amount of sadness too, just seeing that it's not there anymore. It just isn't there. I felt bad that they moved out of the Cambridge building, because it's Cambridge. I was a toddler. Well, why did Lever Brothers leave Cambridge? Why did Ford stop making cars? But it was taken over by Polaroid, their assembly plant. But there's, I think when you look at it, especially if you have personal experience with the landscape, you do see, you just do see Bainbridge at the corner of Melcher. You do go down Atlantic Avenue at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning and imagine that maybe a locomotive's coming your way. So you hope you're not too hot over.
there's like a certain, like you say, there's like a sadness, I think, especially as we get older and we've seen the landscape change a lot. Yeah. When I was young here in Los Angeles, I thought the whole world looked like LA because it was always in, every TV show and movie. Yeah. And certain things I always thought would be landmarks, year by year, decade by decade, they go away. And sometimes I thought to take photos of them, sometimes I didn't. And I mean, they're even talking about taking down the Hollywood sign, it's just, nothing sacred with all of this. And I understand that, time moves on or what have you. But when I see these pictures that you've taken for the book and also just around the area, just cool buildings, in your area, it seems like there's this kind of paradox because the Boston-Cambridge area, it's history, right? It's a historical area, but also it seems like so much of it has just basically just turned into like your typical, generic urban landscape that you see in any big city these days with the big glass and metal skyscrapers and just a lot of crowding where it's hard to see the skyline.
Yeah, it's depressing, actually. New England were a little luckier because New Englanders never throw things out. I learned that every Sunday if I want to go out antiquing with Diane. So, they say, and it makes its way into my room, my music room, as you can see behind me. But it's, we tend to preserve stuff around here. A little less so in New York, but there's a lot of stuff in New York. In New York, I have to say, it's because of gentrification. These wonderful delicatessens and corner stores, candy stores and the like, they're gone, because why have a thing when you put a Starbucks in there? They'll draw three times the rent. So it's just, it's a shame, I suppose. I suppose you can't stop progress. I mean, I don't know.
But we can at least capture the past for now as much as we can, which I feel you did a splendid job of helping us with this. And that's the way I look at it now. Get those pictures, get those stories while you can.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to be around forever.
I'd do it again in a heartbeat, darling. I thoroughly enjoy it. I think I actually am doing something important without getting too, I don't know. I can't find the word for it now. But, I really enjoy doing it. I do it again in a heartbeat. And I've been published before, but nothing like this. So I thank you for the opportunity. And I thank you for the interview as well. There's probably more than the 15 minutes we agreed on.
I know. What have we done? I was about to run out here.
See, I knew it would happen. That's why I blocked off 30 minutes. I was going to block off more, but no. I didn't want to say, you know, I don't want to keep you here too long.
Well, I have all day, but of course you don't have all day for your show. Yeah. But yeah, no, this has been really great. I want to thank you, of course, for having me on the show.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. It's exciting to be any part of the Desperate Hours because I'm such a fan.
Yeah, you know, you have. You've supported the show, you know, and Joe has too. I truly appreciate the content that you've donated or passed on to me, the ideas, because I, you know, and just speaking for myself, I hate being monochromatic. I mean, anybody can throw together a rock show, just like anybody can boil some spaghetti and put a little bit of, you know, sauce on. It doesn't mean you can open up a restaurant. You know, and it doesn't mean, you know, like if I throw rock out there, you know, there's hundreds of other shows, people my age doing it. And that's why I like playing, you know, geez, I have Walter Brennan in my collection. Why aren't I playing it? I have another Jim Nabors record for $2. You know, I think I'm going to play that. No, this one, you know, and you with your sunshiny voice on the ID, I have to play something really either sad, mawkish, perverse. It has to, you know, it just walks right into it. What? How else could, you know, I don't know if anybody else would think of that, but I know I did.
I just always laugh. I laugh, you know, through the tears with these maudlin songs.
Anyway. Yeah, thank you for taking the time, darling. Seriously.
Oh, yeah, it's 7:39 Eastern Time. These are the Desperate Hours on 91.5 FM, WMFO in Medford. Station wants you to know the medical mistakes claim tens of thousands of lives a year. Help reduce your risk. Visit www.ahrq.gov. This is a message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AHRQ, the Ad Council. Yes, the healthy skeptics here at WMFO in Medford. Anyway, just heard the Ramones from the Leave Home LP, 1977 on Sire. And What's Your Game? And before that, really, really quick 28 minutes with Darlene Lacey talking about her candy wrapper museum and the two new books released last month, Necco, An Epic Candy Tale, and Necco, The Archive Collection, An Almost Lost History of the New England Confectionery Company. And also remember that the Candy Wrapper Museum does have a YouTube channel, so you can subscribe to that. You know, push them to put out more more videos, as well as on Instagram. They're on Instagram and Facebook. So go over there and like it. Throw them a bone. And, of course, the books are available on the world's largest online retailer, Amazon. And you should go over there and purchase both volumes. Anyway, we got about 19 minutes to go. We're going to go straight through. Of course, have a talk break at the end. Back on those songs. Anyway, these are the Desperate Hours on WMFO in Medford.
I just can't get enough of you, baby. There just ain't enough of you to go around. Just when I'm needing you, baby, you ain't nowhere to be found. Baby, it's getting me down, 'cause I'm all strung out on you, baby. All strung out on you, baby.
Hey, how you doing? This is JT of In the Red with JT and Heidi Lee, and you're listening to my close friend and musical associate, Alex Piandez, with the Desperate Hours on WMFO 91.5 Tufts University, Medford. Douchebag.
I've been a-searching all this big wide world. Now finally I've found my...
Sunshine and lollipops here in Candyland, California, for me, Darlene Lacey, curator of the Candy Wrapper Museum. So, when I want those gray clouds to clear up, I put on Alex at the Desperate Hours, 91.5 WMFO, Medford, Massachusetts.
Small sad Sam, small sad Sam.
Here's a tale of a man who was puny and weak, stood 4'6" in his stocking feet. Kinda narrow in the shoulder and heavy in the waist. Everything about him seemed to be misplaced. Small Sam.
Small sad Sam.
He slid into town one rainy night, running like a dog away from a fight. He had a pretty big mouth for a guy his size, and everything he said was a pack of lies. Small Sam.
Small sad Sam.
One day he got on a downtown bus. First thing you know, there was an awful fuss. They threw Sam off into the street for trying to steal an old lady's seat. That's Sam.
Small sad Sam.
One day, nobody knows what for, an elevator stuck on the 85th floor. Some cables broke, and so it said, that car just hung there by a thread. The women were calm, the men were mild, but Sam screamed and cried like a little child. He squeezed himself through the emergency door and pulled himself up to the 86th floor. Small Sam. Chicken Sam.
That Chicken Sam.
And then instead of helping others get free, Sam said, I'm looking out for me. The cable snapped and all the way down, they cursed out Sam till they hit the ground. Small Sam.
Small sad Sam.
Now someday Sam's gonna get his due, and when he does, I'll make a bet with you. There ain't nobody even gonna pass the hat, 'cause Sam was nothing but a no-good cat.
Small Sad Sam.
Yes, yeah, Small Sam.
Small Sad Sam.
Chicken Sam.
Small Sad Sam.
No good Sam.
Small Sad Sam.
This is Doc Williams. Thousands have learned to play the guitar by ear from my simplified by-ear guitar instruction course without knowing a note of music. So can you. I know you can learn if you'll only try. Play the guitar a little every day. Every time you see your guitar, pick it up and play a few chords, if only for a minute. In this way, you will develop calluses on your fingers, and also you'll get your fingers used to the proper positions for each chord. Also, as your fingers callus and strengthen, you'll hold your chords down tighter, making them sound clean and clear. Another important thing, is your guitar neck or fingerboard straight, or is it warped, thus making your guitar hard to finger? Now, to check your guitar fingerboard, look down the fingerboard like a rifle barrel from the tuning end. It should be straight. If it is not, you may need to buy a new guitar.
Up in the big rock candy mountain, the cops have wooden legs. The bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's law is a full of hay, his wife wears a satin dress. Oh, well, I'm gonna go where the wind don't blow, it don't rain, and it don't snow in the big rock candy mountain. Up in the big rock candy mountain, the jails are made of tin. If by mistake you get locked up, you can walk right out again. You sleep all day neath the gumdrop trees, you drink from the lemonade springs. Oh, well, I'm gonna go where the wind don't blow, it don't rain, and it don't snow in the big rock candy mountain. Up in the big rock candy mountain, there grows a money tree, but nobody pays any mind to it, 'cause everything is free. All the cows give a chocolate milk, the women outnumber the men. That's why I'm gonna go where the wind don't blow, it don't rain, and it don't snow in the big rock candy mountain. The cops have wooden legs, the hens lay soft-boiled eggs, the jails are made of tin, and the women outnumber the men. That's why I'm gonna go where the wind don't blow, it don't rain, and it don't snow in the big rock candy mountain.
You see what you've done? You stopped the show.
Oh, yeah, it's 7:55 Eastern Time, and they're playing that song. You know what that means. These were the Desperate Hours on 91.5 FM, WMFO in Medford, featuring rock and roll, rhythm and blues, punk, pop, track, and a whole bunch of other stuff like European film soundtracks, song poems, and other junk. Well, the country, too. Other junk from the has-been, should-have-beens, woulda-couldas, and never-were's from the 50s through the turn of the century. My name is Alex, and each and every Thursday evening from the hours of, between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I serve up a steaming pile of compilation cuts and drill-outs. Let me tell you what I played to close out the show. Just heard Bill Phillips and his rendition of Big Rock Candy Mountain from 1972 on Decca. For that, Phil McLean, Little Novelty. Give us a spear, give us a spearing us from the sorrow this week, darling. Phil McLean with Small Sad Sam, 1961 on Versatile. For that, the Four Seasons with Candy Girl, 1963 on the VJ label. And before that, we kicked off the set, last set of the evening, and the show, Nino Tempo and April Stevens with All Strung Out from the album of the same name, White Whale, in 1967. Anyway, hats off to Darlene Lacey for agreeing to the interview. It was awesome. It was awesome being involved with her books, Necco, An Epic Candy Tale, and Necco, The Archive Collection, An Almost Lost History of the New England Confectionery Company. Anyway, it was a pleasure having her on, and I hope you buy the book. It looks like it's really good. Check out the Candy Wrapping Museum channel on YouTube. Also on Instagram as well as Facebook. Anyway, hey, while you're at it, if you're on Instagram, follow me there, The Desperate Hours. Throw me a bone. Anyway, my name is Alex. It's always a pleasure. It's mine. Oh, hats off to Joe Lacey for pulling out roughly half the tunes I played. It was definitely a different show. I really appreciate it. Anyway, my name is Alex. The pleasure is mine. I'll be talking at you next week. Take care.
Pittsburgh rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up and she's running like I never before. There's a speed on ahead, well, all right. I don't see a cop in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. I got my 10 forward gears and a George overdrive. I'm taking little white pills and my eyes open wide. I just passed a Jimmy and a white. I've been a passing everything in sight. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. But it seems like a month since I kissed my baby goodbye. I could have a lot of women, but I'm not like a some other guy. I could find the one to hold me tight, but I could never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. ICC is a ticking on down the line. But I'm a little overweight and my logbook's way behind. But nothing bothers me tonight. I can dodge all the scales all right.